was exactly a year ago today that I submitted my book review of My Father Was a Freedom Fighter to the editor of Palestine Solidarity Campaign's magazine. And so it just seems fitting and right that I'm here a year later with Rumsey, and I'm delighted that you're in the UK with us today. He's on the last leg of his tour, and so I'm quite happy that he's saved the best to last. So can I ask you to join me in welcoming Rumsey this evening too? Okay, well, it's the clarity of expression and the textbook account of a complicated history of Gaza against a backdrop of real lives that made this book such a convincing reading for me. Being all too easy to dismiss the book as yet another version of Palestine's struggle and pain, it paved an unambiguous channel of explanation to the regions, to anyone interested in the current turbulent Middle East, and particularly turbulent in the last few months. It pulls together many strands to define the situation in a historical, social, political, economic, geographical, legal and literary framework to meticulously position the pieces of the jigsaw to portray a rational explanation for the incensed and continues to be incensed Gaza. I thought the book was articulate yet pithy, educational, full of humility and witty. The measured build-up of the memoir is wonderful. For example, at the time of being a high school student, in his own words, and confrontations with IDF soldiers around the outbreak of the First Intifada, Rumsey gets into a little bit of trouble. Rumsey's heart-rending tale is a loving tribute to his father, Muhammad, who is courageous and valiant, enduring 7 decades of hardship, being driven out of his village to a refugee camp, taking up arms to fight the occupation while trying to raise a family, and finally motivating not only his children, but the community in which he lived to continue the struggle. In considering Palestinian and Israeli political figures, and in the detailed analysis of the reasons behind the events, I think Rumsey enables us to understand many unanswered questions. He explores the growth of political parties, tracks their evolution, dissects probable causes of problems, and offers fascinating insights. The geography of the book involves Algeria, Cairo, Jerusalem, Mecca, and Washington, as much as Gaza and the Arabian Desert. Rumsey looks from within and outside the world as he weaves a narrative, incorporating the life of a remarkable man, which could be applied as a familiar tale of many freedom fighters in Gaza, and interprets it in a world context with fine accomplishment. And this evening, we're going to take a closer look at the book. And I'd just like to start off by reading you a short passage from the book. Engulfed by my own rebellious feelings, I picked up another stone and a third. I moved forward, even as bullets flew, even as my friends began falling all around me. I could finally articulate who I was, and for the first time on my own terms. My name is Rumsey, and I was the son of Muhammad, a freedom fighter from Nusayrat, who was driven out of his village of Beit Daras, beside the grave of my brother, and the grandson of the peasant who died with a broken heart, and was buried beside the grave of my brother, a little boy who died because there was no medicine in the refugee camp's UN clinic. My mother was Zarife, a refugee who couldn't spell her name, whose illiteracy was compensated for by a heart overflowing with love for her children and her people, a woman who had the patience of a prophet. I was a free boy, in fact, I was a free man. And this evening, we have a free man. Ramzi is here this evening to tell us about that incident onwards. Ramzi.
First, thank you very much for this lovely introduction and for the Middle East Monitor and PSC and all the lovely people who are here tonight. In fact, the story of Gaza doesn't really start in Gaza. It starts somewhere else. It starts in Palestinian villages, 518 of them, that were destroyed by Zionist militias in 1947, 1948. And I think there's this kind of common misconception, and I think it was a very politicized and manipulated conception that constantly locates Gaza and associates Gaza as much as the West Bank and Jerusalem to 1967. And it's deliberate in the sense that it denies everything that existed prior to that. So, and that's one thing I tried to do from the onset, is I located the story where it should have been located, back in Palestine, in historic Palestine, in these villages. And I told the story of one of them, and that is the village of Beit Daras. That's the village where I come from, where my family comes from. But I say I come from it, although I've never seen it, I've never been there. I've heard so much about it. But the interesting thing, I've never identified with any other place but that village. And that is the same for most Palestinian refugees, whether they are in South Lebanon, in Jordan, in Gaza, in the West Bank, anywhere. This is the reality of it. We come from villages. They don't exist, but they exist in memory, and that's our power, our real power, our ability to connect back to those roots. So I thought it's only proper to start the story from there, and that's how Beit Daras falls into it.
Okay. So the village of Beit Daras has a little passage associated with it.
That's right. Well, before I read the passage to you, I want to tell you that one of the early things I've heard about Beit Daras is an argument that my grandparents used to have all the time about Beit Daras. Apparently, in 1948, when the refugees of Beit Daras, and by the way, Beit Daras is, you know, there are all sorts of stereotypes about Beit Daras, and those of from Gaza maybe know this, that Badrasawis, or people from Beit Daras, are known for having large heads, are always told that you are from Beit Daras, you have a large head. And it's not that we physically have large heads. I think it's just because we were very, very stubborn people. And we took it very personal when the Zionists asked us to leave our village. So we were fighting for Palestine, but we were also were fighting for Beit Daras itself. That's why there were three battles, ending with the great battle of Beit Daras and the massacre of Beit Daras as well. And unfortunately, many people never heard of the massacre of Beit Daras, as well as the many massacres that took place in Palestine at the time, simply because they were not validated by any other narrative aside from the Palestinians. So it kind of been discounted and dropped out of history. And it's important that we bring it back. But back to the blankets. You know, my grandparents used to have this argument over blankets. And my grandma, Zainab, was a very... She liked to argue. And grandpa was the imam of the mosque back in Beit Daras. Very kindly, quiet man. And he just... But if he did actually push the envelope with her, she would always summon in that argument over the blankets. So this passage is related to the blankets, the new blankets in Beit Daras. Why bother to haul the good blankets on the back of a donkey, exposing them to the dust of the journey, while we know that it's a matter of a week or so before we return to Beit Daras? He told his bewildered wife, Zainab. Many years later, Grandma Zainab would repeat this story with a chuckle, and Grandpa Muhammad would shake his head with an awkward mix of embarrassment and grief. I cannot pinpoint the moment when my grandfather, that beautiful old man with the small white beard and humble demeanor, discovered that his good blankets were gone forever. That all that remained of his village were two giant concrete pillars and piles of cactus. I know that he had never given up hope to return to Bedaras, perhaps to the same small mud brick house with the duck tower on the roof. Bedaras's inconsequential existence of the present would espouse little interest, save two concrete pillars that once upon a time served as an entrance to a small mosque. Its walls, as those faithful to its walls, are long gone, yet somehow they still insist on identifying with that serene place and that simple existence. On that very spot, on the shoulder of that small hill, huddled between numerous meadows and fences of blooming cactus, there once rested that lovely little village. And also there, somewhere in the vicinity of the two existing giant concrete pillars, in a tiny mud brick home with a small extension used for storing crops and a duff tower on the roof, my father, Muhammad Baroud, was born.
Thank you. So, did your grandmother and grandfather ever resolve that argument?
Well, no, obviously not, because Grandpa stayed in a refugee camp until he died many years later. And there's something really interesting I'd like to say here. Grandpa was a worldly man, in the sense, in the context of the time, of course. You know, he was a basket weaver, and I'm not going to lie to you, he did not own much land. You know, you kind of hear this quite often. My dad used to own enough land where you kind of, you know, run with your horse from, you know, down to... No, he didn't. He actually had a very small plot of land in Beit Daras. And I think it's really essential that we remember this. Most of the peasants, most of the fallaheen in Palestine, they come from very humble backgrounds. They did not, and that is really interesting, because when this conflict is being defined, it's always defined based on material values. It's a territorial struggle, and of course in part it is. But for us, our relationship with the land wasn't that of the actual tangible value. It was of what it actually meant to us. So Grandpa lived with this idea that one day he will go back to Beit Daras, although once again his return would be to a very tiny plot of land back in Beit Daras.
All right, and so what happened in Gaza?
Well, in Gaza, now, the before the refugees became refugees, there was a struggle, and that led to a Nakba. And I know that we often associate Nakba, and we should, with the humanitarian catastrophe that it yielded. But I think, in a way, sometimes we overlook the fact that there was much more than a Nakba. There was much more than the mere catastrophe. There was a resilient nation there, well-defined, self-assertive, that fought so very hard. And they did not let go that easily. And Grandpa Muhammad was one of them. In Beit Daras, they had 6 rifles. 2 did not work. And they fought until the end, and again it resulted in the massacre of Beit Daras. But then, of course, a decision had to be made, and it was it wasn't really thought through. I mean, there was no. I traced Beit Daras back to 1250, and I know that it existed prior to that, but it was mentioned in Mamluk's writings. 1250, there was a post office in Beit Daras, and all the conquerors that came and lived never really destroyed Beit Daras, except that the Zionists, they did. So you can imagine that people live with that historical understanding of their existence, of where they belong, of who they are, and that long, long relationship to history, and suddenly they have to face the fact that it's all over. So they haven't really made plans of what do we do next. And there's a passage, if you don't mind me reading, when they finally made up their mind and they decided to leave.
We are going to bring the conversation to Gaza today a little bit later on.
Yes. Grandpa Muhammad mounted his faithful donkey with a few of the family's belongings and young daughter Maryam, Ibrahim was in his mother's arm. Ahmed walked alongside his father. And my father, Muhammad, barefoot and confused, trotted behind. It was another trail of tears of sorts. Neither parent had answers to the children's insistent questions. Where are we going? They headed south. That was all they knew. First to Isdud, then to Hamami, then to Gaza. Everywhere they settled, they were chased with mortars and airplanes and bombs. As the bombardments progressed and more villages were razed, the roads became more and more populated, some people carrying on with a great sense of urgency, others wandering aimlessly and in a daze. Grandpa Muhammad was a man of faith. He insisted that if the Arabs were to abandon the Palestinians, God would not. Muddied with bloody feet and empty bellies, the children could hardly argue with their father's wisdom. Even as they passed an occasional body in the middle of the road, or a frantic mother running the opposite direction, weeping for her lost children. God will take care of us, Grandpa Muhammad encouraged. Yet there was no one in sight but fleeing refugees, blown up bodies, starved children, and crying women. What kept Bedara standing for 1,000 years can always bring it back, he insisted. But the many trucks and numerous donkeys walking the dirt road, loaded with whatever families managed to salvage, told of another story. The number of refugees was growing by the hour. In Bedara, everyone knew everyone, but not anymore. The number of familiar faces was dwindling. Many died. Many fled elsewhere. And those heading to Gaza were now joined by so many new faces, equally pale and teary, from numerous villages that extended beyond the world of Bedaras. So now, they end up in Gaza, and they had to deal with this new reality. It was a completely alien world for them. And I think, I mean, it's really difficult to even trying to communicate that in words. I mean, you have the psychological element here, that I'm completely uprooted.
Yeah.
There is no prospects of, you know, thinking of anything beyond survival at this point. Gaza at the time had about 80,000 people, largely nomadic tribes, but small Christian and Muslim communities in urban areas. And really, in historical terms, overnight, over 200,000 people just ended there. And there was no one there for their aid, except later on the Quakers came. And that's why I have this.
But all the time, the feeling that they were going to go back any minute.
That in fact, existed until the war of 1967.
Yeah.
And there's a little story, if you don't mind me sharing, about the going back any minute thing, is that Grandpa had a radio transistor that was always kind of turned on the news, always. And when he had faith that the Arabs would come and liberate us, it was turned on the Saut al-Arab, the Arab voice. And after 1967, naturally, he turned it to another channel. And I think when he died, it was Monte Carlo. And, you know, I'm sure that he would have lost faith of it by now. But at the time, there was... And he was under the impression that there would be this broadcast on the radio that did not say... The refugee problem has been resolved, people can go back home. No, he was actually under the impression that the broadcast would state, people of Beit Daras, go home. And as a result, I had, an uncle, his name is Munir, he kind of liked to tease Grandpa. So what he would do, the moment that Grandpa would walk away from the radio, he's in the kitchen, in the bathroom, he's doing something somewhere, and then he would yell, Dad, they are saying something about Beit Daras. And then Grandpa would come running back to the radio. And I thought, okay, the 10th time he said this, you should have discovered that he's lying. And he did it 500 times, and every single time I know that Grandpa knew that he was lying. But I think he had this faint hope that what if they are indeed saying something about Beit Daras?
Maybe a superstitious idea that if he didn't go running back to the radio, then it wouldn't happen. So he had to do it. Okay. And so then did your father become involved in any way with defending Gaza? Did he move on to becoming a freedom fighter? Did he join up, did he enlist, or was he sort of gradually...
Well, he didn't, because he was still 10 at the time. So in Gaza, he was 10.
Eventually.
And there was really nothing in Gaza for as far as survival is concerned, except of relying on the trickles of aid that were coming, and also on begging. So he began to beg, along with, of course, thousands of children in Gaza. But what do you do when everybody is poor? I mean, where do you go begging? And one of the places where he went was the Egyptian army encampments. Now, the Egyptian army was defeated.
Nothing's changed there, then.
Right. And they were, you know, they are still in Gaza at the time. And he would go and he would extend his arm through the fence. And along with so many children would be hanging around all the time hoping for, a piece of bread. And that's what he did. And, of course, you can imagine the level of humiliation that he felt as a child going through this. But I think... That was the moment where really the whole concept of freedom fighting, I think it was directly related to the loss of Palestine and the level of collective humiliation that was felt by the Palestinian refugees. And I've got to add something here. When we think violence and non-violence, resistance or no resistance, we all always kind of subscribe to this discourse that this is almost like a technical question or a tactical question. You know, should Palestinians use violence? And I say, if you really truly appreciate Palestinian history, again, the way it is, not the way we think it ought to be, you would truly understand that resistance in Palestine goes back to so many years, and it was not a matter of strategy. It was a matter of necessity. And that's how the Fida'iyin concept, the freedom fighters, became part and parcel of the Gaza, collective Gaza psyche at the time.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And now I think we'll move the story on a little bit to the next passage regarding the marriage.
I think there's a couple of things I wanted to touch upon before.
So, okay, so let's go rewind a little bit. So the freedom fighter, your father would then continue and join up.
That's right. Well, let me tell you how his link to the Fida'iyin started, and then we'll take it from there.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The Fida'iyin were mostly Palestinian guerrilla commandos that took their daring strikes deep inside Israel. They were mostly young Palestinian refugees, but also included some Egyptian fighters who operated outside the scope of their government, Islamic fighters and others. Their operations grew bolder by the day. They would sneak into Israel like ghosts in the night with primitive weapons and homemade bombs. They would kill Israeli soldiers, steal their weapons, and return with the new weapons the second night. Some would sneak back to their villages in Palestine. They would steal food, blankets, and whatever money they had saved but failed to retrieve in the rush of war. Those who never returned received the funerals of martyrs, where thousands of refugees would march carrying symbolic coffins into some graveyard. Indeed, hundreds wouldn't return, and few bodies were ever recovered. Following every Fida'iyin strike, the Israeli army would strike Gaza's refugees, inspiring yet more support and recruits for the growing commando movement. Muhammad saw in the Fida'iyin and their stories a heroic escape from his humiliating life. Freedom fighting became his new calling. The Fida'iyin was the antithesis to his humiliation and submissiveness, and a manifestation of all the anger and frustration he felt. He wanted to go back to Beit Daras so badly that he would constantly investigate whether any of the commanders passed by his village had a glimpse of his old school by the hill. He offered his services as a watchman for the Fida'iyin as they made their initial and most dangerous crossovers into Israel. He would try to impress his family with his bravery and join a resistance group as soon as possible. But he didn't, not yet at least.
Okay.
Instead, he ran away from home, and he ended up in the middle of the Sinai Desert.
All right. So can you just, I know you have one or two stories about his foray into the desert and his trip to Saudi Arabia.
Right. Yes, you know,
there
was a period of self-introspection, you know. He wanted to run away, basically. And he knew that Bid Daras was not an option.
He hadn't fallen in love yet.
Not yet. Yeah,
okay,
I'll tell you about this part later.
Okay.
And he basically kind of jumps on this train that connected. There was this train that used to go all the way through Palestine and you know, through Gaza to the Sinai Desert all the way to Cairo. But after the war, of course, there was this disconnect, and he could not, and the train would not go to Palestine anymore. So it operated from Gaza to Egypt through Sinai. That was after the war of 1956. That's when the United Nations or international forces were brought in to Sinai. And he knew nothing of this. He just wanted to run away from it all. So he jumps in an empty cart in the train, and he goes to Sinai, and he sees the United Nations soldiers standing there, waiting for the train to arrive. He panics, and he jumps out, and he runs into the desert. And he finds himself living with this Bedouin tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those of us familiar with Bedouin cultures in Palestine, you would know their legendary generosity.
Absolutely.
They are generous beyond belief.
So did he drink lots of coffee?
Oh, obviously he did. But at the time, he, you know, the, you know, in Bedouin culture, they say that they can't ask a stranger about his name if he's seeking shelter in their dwellings for 3 days and a third. 3 days makes sense, you know, to give that person enough time to. But the third, still really kind of, I don't understand why the third. But in any case, he found himself there, and then he decided to stay, and they welcomed that. But he wanted to contribute somehow to life, in the tribe. And then he made some outrageous claims. One of them, he knew that nobody knew how to read or write in there. And he made the first claim that he was literate. And he could really, I mean, that was outrageous in the sense that he could barely read or write. And then he made another one that he's actually scholarly, he can actually teach. And a third one, which is even more dangerous, he claimed that he could teach them the Quran. So overnight, he becomes a Quranic teacher.
Oops.
And here they would be sitting, and they would be kind of reading, and then he would be making up all these, you know, the meaning of the Quran as he carried on.
So obviously the gene of storytelling continues to his grandson.
But there was this inquisitive student. There was inquisitive student who used to ask, maybe he's illiterate, but certain meanings are obvious in the Quran. You just said this, but the verse clearly says that. And that's when my dad kind of came up with this notion that questioning his explanation is really like equivalent to questioning the Quran itself. So the poor guy basically kind of held back and said absolutely nothing. And he got away with it for about a year. And then he decided to go back to Gaza. And there was this self-assertiveness. Kind of he found himself in the desert. And he was kind of in a way a changed person.
Mm.
And he immediately joined the army.
Yeah.
And it was the Egyptian army at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So your father joined the Egyptian army, and was he in it for very long?
Not very long. It was perhaps a year or so. And I don't think there were much in terms of battles at the time. He was obsessed with Russian literature. He loved the whole concept of solidarity. He just liked that. And in fact, he used to make these claims that he was a communist. Really, he wasn't. He used to say that he was. I mean, he prayed five times a day and everything. But then he used to talk a great deal about modes of production and the Second International and all of this. And many of the refugees in Gaza would, you know, like, modes of production. I mean, there's nothing but citrus in Gaza. You know, but he insisted that there is a world beyond Gaza, and there is international solidarity. And one day, only if the proletariat of the world unite at the right time, you know, everything is going to be okay. So he would be sitting as a soldier during his breaks under a fig tree I'm not sure if it's still in Maghazi. Yusuf, you need to check for me, please. But there's this tree. He used to always hang around and read his books there. And that's when my mom, who was about 15 at the time, would be walking back and forth. And that's where he saw her, and he fell in love.
Oh. So that was a moment, a turning point where he, Muhammad, kind of got slightly diverted from his communist books and maybe fighting for freedom for a little while.
That's right. Even a warrior needs a time of rest sometimes. and he goes, he asks her mom for her hand, and she asked for really outrageous, she had outrageous demands. And you know, I'm not sure, you know, if things have changed in Gaza recently, but if I remember correctly, the culture there, we had a very specific way of asking for dowry. So you would kind of ask, for example, you always had to have a brand new watch of a very good quality placed inside a purse. You know, so the purse and the watch is something that he needed to bring. And, of course, the necklace and the bracelet and all of this.
And, of course, he couldn't afford to
do
that.
He couldn't. So he had to go to Saudi Arabia. And he did all sorts of things in Saudi Arabia. You know, there is a section in the book called Mecca, anyone. And he basically kind of crosses the desert in Egypt, and he ends up, you know, crosses the Red Sea, and he ends up being there in Mecca. Really not knowing.
He tries to go there several times, doesn't he?
That's right. And he gets there, finally, and he becomes a barber in Mecca. And again, he really didn't know anything.
He has a series of different jobs.
He did. But I think the most interesting...
And he became very popular with a certain clientele.
That's right. Now you are reminding me of that story.
Perhaps we could
I will tell you that story. But it's important that I'm highlighting these stories to tell you how resourceful Palestinians are.
Well, and they continue to be.
You know, and, you know, I mean, with, under the siege, for example, you know, I mean, who had ever thought that you can run a car on falafel oil? But they did. And there's a million other way, you know, of survival. And he's just part of that culture as well.
Totally environmentally friendly, too.
That's right. But, you know, all of Gaza smelled like falafel for weeks. Yeah, one of the things he did there was he had a table in which he sold his knickknacks. And he had some sort of a cream. I really have no idea what
it
did.
It's in Mecca.
In Mecca, mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's this lady, she was a Somali woman who lived in Mecca, and she came and she asked him, she said, you know, I have this fever and I have all these problems and my body aches and all of this. And he wanted to make a sell, I mean, you know, so he goes, well, take this cream and just rub it all over. Wrap yourself in a blanket. And we're talking about Mecca in the summer here. And just don't do any, just, you know, lie in bed until the morning and you're going to be just fine.
It was a good job she didn't go under the sun with all that oil.
And she did. And he said the next day she came and she was charging, you know, coming from the opposite. And he said, oh, no, this is the lady. And he thought it just a little. And she actually came. He thought he was in big, big trouble.
Yeah.
And then she came and she told him, God bless you. What a one. I mean, I feel... No pain and all of this. And then he becomes really popular among the, you know,
the
middle-aged ladies with you know.
With ailments.
Exactly, with all sorts
go
of
go and
ailments.
See the young man. He'll give you a potion.
But finally he makes his fortune and he goes back to Gaza. And
does he buy the dowry?
He does. And of course, you know, the dowry included sunglasses. That was essential. And it was essential. Sunglasses
in
were...
In those days, yeah.
It was a big luxury, but they were particularly important because international forces and aid workers who came to Gaza, they brought sunglasses with them. And then, you know, to be kind of stylish and modern, people asked for sunglasses. So he was asked to bring sunglasses, and he did. Can I read the passage about that?
Please do, yes.
In a refugee camp, a wedding is a most happy occasion for the entire community. Rarely do the refugees gather with such enthusiasm and joy amid song and dance and piles of couscous and baklava. Indeed, Muhammad and Zarifa's wedding was most memorable. Women gathered from near and far to get a glimpse of the lovely young bride who took center stage in her mother's house. The zeffa, or the wedding parade, crossed one refugee camp into another amid celebration and song and joined by hundreds of refugees. Zarifa wore her white gown, which Muhammad had purchased in Egypt, and naturally wore the sunglasses throughout the entire ceremony, even in shade and throughout the evening celebration. During the procession to Muhammad's neighborhood, flocks of little children chased after Zarifa, chanting, "The bride is international, the bride is international." This reference was, of course, to her sunglasses, an item that was introduced to Gaza by international aid workers and forces that made a brief appearance in Gaza after the Israeli withdrawal at the end of the 1956 war. Zarifa took so much pride in that designation and held on her sunglasses for years until they mysteriously disappeared.
Oh, it's a sweet story. And maybe Yusuf can give us an update with regards to the sunglasses in Gaza.
Well, there are different questionable stuff going on there, especially with the young people. Some of them were brought in through the tunnels.
Oh, thank you.
That's great. So the legacy continues.
It's just a slightly different way. All right, so parents got married, and obviously...
And Muhammad joins the army.
Yep.
But this time, it wasn't the Egyptian army. And of course, you know, we are skipping chapters here, and I am not touching on the politics, but I really tried to situate the personal narrative within the larger collective and
exactly.
even political narrative.
Exactly.
So he joins not the Egyptian army, he joins the Palestine Liberation Army, which is a product of the PLO at the time. But really, more or less, it was still under the command of the Egyptian army, but was largely made of Palestinian fighters, and he was one of them. And of course, the mood was very high. I mean, people... Two things. People believe that the war is going to be won. Mm. And the second thing, they were not talking of anything at the time but going back, to the point that the term return was included in the way that the soldiers were training for battle. So they would be jumping through hoops and that sort of things, and they would be screaming, "Auda, auda, auda," which means return, return, return. So that was the rally cry for the Palestinian fighters at the time. They really made that association so very clear. But unfortunately, and as you know, the war... was lost and in a very humiliating way,
yeah.
And the dream of return at the time was crushed. And instead of Muhammad coming back victorious to Zarifa, and now she has her daughter Suma with her in the Nusayrat refugee camp, he gets wounded, and he finds himself being hauled into Egypt,
mm-hmm.
and Zarifa is stuck at an orchard in Gaza waiting for him to come back. And I'm going to...
So that's the passage from around 67.
That's right.
Okay.
Muhammad was barefoot. His army boots were too heavy, and his toes blistered and bled. His legs were wounded from shrapnel, yet somehow he felt no pain. He watched the blood slowly flowing from his wounds and did nothing. The air smelled of blood and salt. The haggard army truck that carried Muhammad across the desert was now an all-purpose vehicle, transporting living, wounded, but mostly dead soldiers. Those killed, Palestinians and Egyptians, were piled atop one another in no specific order. Some of the wounded were quietly uttering Quranic verses, those that one would recite before his last breath. The truck sped through Sinai, which was no longer barren, for it was speckled with burnt vehicles, scattered bodies, and boots. There were so many boots, the exact same kind that Muhammad still held between his arms. They filled the desert like uprooted trees, and around them were barefooted men lying still. Hiding in an orchard, Zarifa slipped under a tree. She was all alone, and she was afraid. She woke up to a violent commotion, noises partly made in a foreign language with which she was not familiar. The voices drew near. They were abrasive and commanding, interrupted or joined by screams, submissive words pleading in Arabic. "For God's sake, don't take him. He's only a child. I swear by Allah, soldier, my son has never hurt anyone. Please spare him, and may you return safe and sound to your own mother." Such exchanges would soon end with a hail of bullets, then silence, then more screams and shouts in a language with which Zarifa was hardly familiar. But soon after, the commands were loud and clear, barking in a strange but comprehensible Arabic accent through a loudspeaker. "To all of those hiding in the orchard, come out with your hands on your heads. Those who violate the army's order will be shot at once." As Zarifa walked slowly forward, she discovered that she was not alone in that terrible place. Hundreds like her, mothers with their children, old men and women, all began moving in one direction, some quietly whimpering, others in complete silence. Once the crowd emerged from behind the trees, Zarifa came face to face with the Israeli soldiers.
So that was the kind of first taste that your father had of freedom fighting. Real freedom fighting with a passion and with injury. And it was the first time that he met the Fida'iyin. How did that affect him? What did that, in actuality, feel to him?
Well, the fact was, he was a big fan of Jamal Abdel Nasser. He used to call himself a Nasserite. And he was a big fan of Nasser because there was a spirit of resistance that, you know, was espoused and, during that era, and he was part of it. So he wasn't, you know, on the sideline watching things unfold, but he was very much a part of it. And the change, I think, from being a member of the Egyptian armed forces to being a member of the Palestine Liberation Army was also part of that transformation, not only in his character, but also in the collective Palestinian experience. We are becoming more confident, more aware of our own power as a nation. But there was much hope then.
Exactly. I think at the time, it was Gamal Abdel Nasser was seen as somebody who was going to do it for them.
That's right. And until now, you find lots of pictures of Gamal Abdel Nasser. Exactly.
For him.
That's right, and that love continues until today. I mean, you go to Palestinian homes everywhere, Palestine, and you will find pictures of Jamal Abdel Nasser. He meant that much, really. But of course, after the defeat, after the Nakba of 67, things were beginning to change, and the language and the discourse was beginning to change as well. We are no longer talking about return, at least some. We were talking about new realities, about the occupied territories. That was not part of the political dictionary. The Arabs met in Khartoum, in fact, in Egypt, in Sudan, almost immediately after the war. And that was the debate that they had. What are the new ceiling of demands? And of course, the refugees, as far as they are concerned, it was Beit Daras. That was the ceiling of demands, you know, as a microcosm of everything else. But for them, for the Arab leaders, now they understand that there's a new reality. And the Palestinians could not accept it, and they refused to accept it until today. Muhammad also refused to accept that his fate is now will lead him to Israel as a cheap laborer. Remember, he's a principled man. He would not put up with this. So he decided to leave Gaza once more and to find work elsewhere.
And where did he go?
Oh, he'd been to many places. He worked in Lebanon as a construction worker. He worked in agriculture in Syria. And nothing worked for him, and finally he ended up in Saudi Arabia. And he was not on his own. This time he had my aunt's husband. His name is Rasmi. I changed the name in the book to Rafiq, fearing liability, because I wasn't very kind to Rasmi. He was a nice man, but he loathed the very idea of work. He just didn't like it. He would be hanging around at the coffee shop. We called the casino, the beach casino of Nusayrat. It's really not a casino, of course, in the traditional sense, just tables and coffee and 7-ups. But he would be playing poker there all day, and my dad was forced to take him, you know, to do something, you know, with him and help him feed his family. So they end up in Saudi Arabia. They are in a small town near Jeddah, and they put it all on the line, and they decide to invest. And they invested in a falafel stand. And that's the falafel terrorists part, if you don't mind me reading it.
Okay, so Ramsey's going to read the part of the book called The Falafel Terrorist. It's very funny.
Muhammad fired up the grill, and his sidekick, Rafiq, finalized the falafel mix. Things seemed to be moving in the right direction. Muhammad's expectations were falling into place, as the simple sign promising cheap price for an exquisite meal generated much interest, including, regrettably, that of the local police. Alarmed at the presence of many immigrants standing in one long line, for falafel was perhaps an unknown delicacy in parts of Saudi Arabia at the time. Muhammad calculated that once the first batch of falafel was ready, he would send Rafiq with a few warm sandwiches to pacify the snooping police and keep them at bay. Together, Muhammad dreamed that these two would make their fortune and return to their families with wealth unimaginable. He let his daydreams get away from him as he called to the crowd that they were in for one of the greatest culinary experiences of their lives. Rafiq, known for his laxity and negligence, claimed to have followed the falafel recipe to the letter, but with one critical component Rafiq had improvised, adding excessive quantities of sodium bicarbonate, insisting that it would give their falafel a unique and electrifying taste. At least that's what Muhammad later claimed, and Rafiq fervently denied. Regardless, when the first patties were dropped into the hot oil, amid the growing anticipation of the ever-swelling crowd, disaster struck. Overwhelming amounts of the electrifying secret ingredient caused the falafel to take off and erupt like mini bite-sized grenades. Hot oil splattered everywhere. Morsels exploded in mid-air, and a confused crowd ran in fright, as did as the police. God damn you, Rafiq. God damn you a million times. You ruined me. What have you done? What did you put in the falafel? Muhammad bellowed as they both ran for cover. Rafiq's electrifying ingredient was enough to place a warrant on Muhammad and his companion for disturbing the peace. The falafel terrorists fled the country, never to return, leaving behind the falafel stall and what could have been a successful business venture. Muhammad returned to Gaza with no money and with no intention of ever leaving again.
Thank you. And what did Zarifa make of that?
Well, I'm sure that she was very happy to see him back.
You have to find out. Yeah, absolutely. You have to, if you haven't bought the book already, they're available tonight. And anyway, more about that later. Okay, we're going to fast forward a little bit in the book and jump to the 1987 Intifada.
To the Intifada.
And there's a passage there that I'd like to...
That's right, but maybe
read.
I should kind of set this up
but
somehow.
Set it up.
Yeah. Yep. 1987 is the first Palestinian uprising. We lived in the heart of the refugee camp. So let me kind of help you try to envision.
So the Intifada brought much sorrow and, you know...
Of course.
One of the saddest events was the passing away of your mother.
That's right.
That right. And
and we will be talking about this in a second, but let me first try to position the, you know, our relationship to the Intifada. Now, this is, of course, a popular uprising. It's people's power at work. It was very difficult because there articulating the demands politically was extremely difficult because we did not have, the kind of leadership, unfortunately, that was able to reflect the general demands of the Palestinian people. But as far as the people themselves were concerned, they really held true to their rights, and they fought the good fight for years. They did from 1987 until largely until the Oslo was signed in 1993. My house was located in the center of the refugee camp. The area in front of the house was called the Red Square. You know, for many people were killed and wounded there. So because of the blood, it's the Red Square. To the left, we had the martyrs' graveyard, also self-explanatory. And in front of us, there was the Great Mosque. So it was really a very obvious relationship. Kids come there, they gather, they battle Israeli soldiers with their stones, they get killed, they take them to the mosque for prayer, and then they take them to the martyrs' graveyard to be buried. Whenever the soldiers came to the camp, they would position themselves in that red square, and my house would be the first that they would raid. And in order for my dad, being the very clever person that he was, he kind of developed ways to, you know, kind of to stand between the soldiers and his children. And he was very smart about it. And there is a passage I would like to read about this. Mm-hmm. In our sitting room also sat a basket overflowing with miscellaneous pairs of spectacles. In an array of styles, and many of them taped together and had missing lenses. Beside the basket sat a large stack of books, all classics, from Homer to Hugo, or Aristotle to Zola, ready for an impromptu read at a moment's notice. My father was one of the most ingenious men I've ever met. When you looked at him, you could see the wheels turning in his brain, spinning to soup up a crazy business deal that only he could pull off, or some new creative way to keep the ever-present Israeli forces at bay. So this is how the stage is set. We all line up, and we carry, you know, thick books, and we just sit there, and we put glasses randomly on. His old glasses, the soldiers will come in, and my dad will explain to them in Hebrew that his kids, hi, Mamun, that his kids are actually scholars. They're not troublemakers. And so there's this specific episode. I particularly remember an episode on a sunny curfew afternoon, when we had little time to set the stage before the duel was kicked in. I grabbed a copy of Maxim Gorky's Mother and buried my face in its pages, afraid to look up or make eye contact with those who broke the door down and announced themselves as Jews when they stormed into our home. My father would put up on the most amazing performance. He would grab the old cane that leaned against the wall beside the door for these very instances, and would limp so convincingly to the sitting room, where he would explain in his impeccable Hebrew that his sons were not troublemakers, but scholars. As my father pointed out the fact that we were all enthusiasts of higher literature, I braved out of the pages of my book to find out that my younger brother Munir, who sat across the room from me, wore a pair of glasses that had no lenses at all. He was reflectively taking in another classic, but hadn't noticed that he was holding the book upside down. Although these moments were terrifying, and I had to bite down on my tongue to keep myself from bursting into laughter. God knows what might have happened if Munir or I would have blown our cover.
Thank you. So, jumping to the 1987 First Intifada, we, once again, in the history of Gaza, we see it bringing much sorrow, and one of the saddest events was the passing away of your mother, and...
There's a passage that I was hoping that you would read and show it. Is that possible?
This particular passage is called the Car Downstairs. I was awakened by a friend who told me in a somber voice that my parents were home. He wanted to elaborate, but I gave him no chance, throwing the cover to the side and running to wave to them from the roof. My father was being embraced by neighbours as he stood by a truck with an open flat bed. Inside the truck was a coffin draped with a Palestinian flag. It was my mother. My father soon came upstairs. He hugged us, and we all cried. He gave me a small plastic bag filled with knickknacks that my mother had bought me in Egypt. She sent to you her love and many kisses, my father said. I hid her gifts under my mattress and joined the rest to the refugee camp to bury her. Nusayrat was under a curfew, and the Israeli army agreed to allow her burial on the condition that the immediate family was to be present. Under the monitoring of Israeli soldiers, we arrived at the graveyard carrying the coffin and were soon joined by Maryam, Zarifa's mother, who came running into the graveyard calling out her daughter's name. We began digging, but neighbours peeking through their windows quickly concluded that Zarifa had died and was being buried. My mother was a beloved neighbour. She was particularly adored among the older women of the group, whom Zarifa treated with untold kindness. "Allahu Akbar," resonated a voice coming from one of the refugee homes. Anwar has died," cried another from within minutes. Shouts of "God is great" echoed through the camp. People appeared from everywhere, carrying Palestinian flags, women, children, old men and women and youth, all descended onto the graveyard. Refugees were outraged that the poor woman was to be buried subject to military restrictions and was to be followed even to her grave under the watchful eyes of the occupiers, their guns, tanks, and a hovering army helicopter. Youth began throwing stones, and soldiers responded with bullets and tear gas. But the people were not to disperse easily this time. Thousands of them ensured that Zarifa would depart the earth and enter paradise in the company of friends, treated as a martyr should be treated. As an ambulance hauled some of the wounded to the local clinic, Zarifa was lowered into the ground amidst chants and Quranic verses recited by everyone. Shouts of "Allahu Akbar" were intermingled with the whimpers and prayers of the crowd, the sound of bombs, the tear gas, and the hovering helicopter. My mother was 42 years old when she died. So I guess that backdrop continues today. And now we'd like to move the discussion on to wider political issues of people continuing to die in Gaza today. So, Ramzi, you know, how does that make you feel?
Well, the reason I actually wrote this book, it wasn't necessarily about me exposing my family or trying to share stories. It is because I felt that the Palestinian narrative has been neglected, frankly, or it has been discolored or tainted somehow. There's what something that I call history by association. It's when we try to tell our history because we know that it will not be accepted the way it is for many reasons, including racism and dehumanization of the Palestinian people. So what we do is we do this two kinds of history, actually. History of negation, which is trying to prove through our history that we are not what you think of us. So I'm going to tell you why Palestinians are not terrorists, or just trying to always respond to an already created discourse about who we are. So that's the history of negation. And the history of association, well, in order for me to explain to you and to make my cause more relevant, amiable, I have to constantly borrow from other historical experiences, which is important, I think. Apartheid of South Africa, or American imperialism in South America, and so forth and so on. But at the end of the day, our history ended up being kind of a concoction of so many different versions of history. The authentic history of Palestine and the authentic narrative is not centralized in all of this. It's almost always on the margin. And I felt that it's really time to change this. And of course, it wasn't, you know, I wasn't the only one. I mean, we have some wonderful authors out there with great books trying to alienate the same discourse. And I think it's really important that we appreciate Palestinian history the way it is, not the way we think it ought to be. And that's what I try to do. And I also try to do some justice for Gaza. Because when Gaza is discussed in the media and wrote about, again, it's presented as a crisis. People are dying, you know, people are starving. And there's very little by way of historical connections to why people are dying, why are this. And when we do refer to history, we are very short-sighted in how we cite history.
I mean, what we hear constantly is statistics. X number of people died, X number of people were injured. And these numbers then become very meaningless in many respects because people get used to hearing just numbers. And it would be nice, and this is being done, I think, to connect those numbers to names, real names and people, because then people don't get so desensitized towards it.
Exactly. But I even more to that, which I fully agree with what you said, but even more to that is that, the issue of numbers is easily countered. I mean, we have our facts and figures and charts and maps and say, this is Palestine, basic information about Palestine, on 500 words. Over time, we end up reducing the people of Palestine. I mean, the 8 Palestinians who were killed in Gaza recently, they included 3 children, I believe, 3 children. We know very little about those children. And where do they come from? Where do their parents come from? Why are they in Gaza in the first place? There's always that disconnect. And then we talk about 8, and then someone else would say, well, but Palestinians fired rockets first. And we say, no. If you refer to the BBC report on such and such date, shows that it was Israel. And then we kind of enter into this kind of useless, you know, argument and counter-arguments by presenting a history that is devoid of humanity, devoid of people, devoid of the fact that no, it wasn't about the number of those who were killed, but about why they were killed, why they were there. That's why I think it's so essential that we bring back Palestinian. And I agree that it has been done, but hasn't been done enough.
We've really started at least recognizing a list of names so that we can put a name to a number just to make it more human.
Right.
And I think it's quite right, and that should be done. So, in a way, your book brings that alive because it makes the narrative very personal. It points towards a man and his life story. And very often we don't read about that in the media. We're in too much of a hurry to find out the latest thing that's happened.
Not really, actually.
Because
look at the Israeli story.
Place.
Look at the perception of the Israeli narrative. First of all, we know that the Israeli narrative is centered in an Israeli-centric history. No, the Israeli story doesn't start in Cape Town. It doesn't start in Nicaragua. It actually starts in the Holocaust, in Germany, and starts in Palestine itself. So they have a very centralized and clear historical narrative, and ours is not. And I think it's essential that it becomes that way, not just simply that we recognize that there are people behind the numbers, but if you if you can't see the relevance of Palestinians to this history, over time, what's going to happen is that Palestinians are going to find themselves in this situation where they are told what to do. You know what I mean? I mean,
yes.
like the whole debate, for example, over one state, two states, violence, non-violence, is all these reductionist type of discussions that are taking place everywhere. And I assure you that when I was a student at Birzeit University, we haven't really sat there kind of thinking, what is the solution? One state, two states. And it was completely irrelevant to us. And that's why I'm saying that we've got to really try to appreciate the Palestinian narrative. And by that appreciation, we will start imagining the conflict from a Palestinian point of view. And if we imagine the narrative from a Palestinian point of view, our attitude and our relationship to that narrative would eventually change. And I think it ought to.
And I think it is changing. And I think that in the past, the Arabic historical narrative was very oral, wasn't it?
Right.
And now it's being written and it's being documented. So people will have archives and references to go back to. And I think that's going to help make the argument, because we then have records and statistics on which to draw on. And we're in the throes of all these revolutions now, and why are all these revolutions happening now, what's the impact of them going to be?
Mm. Well, you know, there have been three competing forces, I would say, in the region that we call the Middle East. One that is the Western interventions, American imperialism, neocolonialism, this self-seeking, you know, a bunch that comes from the outside. And the other is the Arab elites and Arab rulers and regimes. And they've been battling it out. Those who concede are called moderates. So that's how you achieve the title, that of moderation in Arab politics. Has nothing to do with the people. They are completely discounted, are out of the equation altogether. And those who fail the American test are the radicals. And the people have been just absent from all of this. They are really just used, you know. One extremely silly manifestation of that is when Americans were kind of realizing that they are losing, you know, public opinion. So they decided, well, maybe we can win hearts and minds in Iraq. So you would see pictures in the New York Times and news reports in CBS of American soldiers handing candy to little kids in Fallujah and Basra. It's absolutely ridiculous that this idea is very patronizing. But again, it makes you think of how little they actually considered and how little they thought of the people. And what is happening right now is that this dimension of this triangle, the new colonialists, the regimes, and the people, is now being changed. The people are kind of becoming a much more relevant factor in this equation. I'm not saying that they have changed the rules entirely, but they are in their way of changing the rules. And at the end of the day, and I think this is really the unwritten chapter in my book, that those who did what they did in Egypt and Tunisia and achieving that in Yemen are the Zarifas and the Muhammads of these countries anyway. They are the people. They are the ones who have been, you know, discounted for all these years, and they are taking charge of charting their own destiny. And I think if it's an indication of anything, is that eventually the Muhammads and the Zarifas of Palestine will be able to articulate their own demands and will be able to assert themselves as a very important factor in all of this.
Well, let's just hope so. And I can't help but feel that the current state of affairs in Palestine and Israel is really the end of the Oslo Agreement. I mean, I think that chapter has been
closed. I think
it
has. I think we live in...
Sorry?
It never started,
but everybody referred to it. That's what I meant.
So even as a frame of reference is no longer even valid anymore. And I think we do live in the post-Oslo years right now. And I think this is why the panic, you know, in the Palestinian Authority and all of this, because they fear that the new reality and the new calculations is not going to include them anymore. And I do think that there is a serious change that is underway in Palestine. And I think it is essential that we insist that this change is not an elitist type of change. We don't want to see changes of faces. And people ask me, you know, wherever you go, there's always that question, you know, the Palestinian Gandhi, and you know, where is the Palestinian Gandhi? Or do you think Marwan Barghouti will? And you know, there's this obsession with finding a man actually, who will make it all right. Again, very patronizing, and this time, I think it has to be done the other way around. It has to be the people, and then the man would emerge after that.
Thank you. And I think also that the discourse regarding statehood, the debate between should it be a single state, should it be a one state, is almost irrelevant now. Because what we're wanting to see is perhaps simple implementation of human rights.
That's right.
And that the discourse regarding statehood really is now closed and becoming irrelevant.
That's right.
Because neither way there seems to be a door open. Or if it is open, then it's marred by a series of obstacles.
Right. You know, I think, you know, there's...
And they're unsurmountable, these obstacles.
I think that the new, there's this kind of new realization that two states are not practical. So out of desperation, we are saying, well, we have nothing but a one state. And in my, I mean, when did the whole two states debate even started? It wasn't a UN resolution 181, you know, to divide the land, because they were not really speaking of a Palestinian state even then. This was an invention in the late 60s, and after the war, after the 1967 war. It was Henry Kissinger who brought all this nonsense to us, of peace process, this and two solutions, that. That was really not part of the political agenda of the Palestinian people. Effectively, there is already a one state.
Yes.
I mean, there are people living in, you know, a
except
million and a half
the,
Palestinians.
You know, the Palestinians within Israel are...
But they are divided by walls and checkpoints and a draconian and racist agenda.
Exactly.
That ensures that these divisions, whether legal divisions or physical divisions, remain in place.
But legal, they certainly are, because, you know, the Knesset has passed no less than 23 laws that discriminate against Palestinians living inside Israel.
Right.
And these laws keep on being updated and revised and tightened to the degree now where, you know, Arabic is not permitted to be spoken in Israel.
But that tells you something, though. It tells you the level of panic that they are reaching in Israel. And indeed, there is this rush. You know, I think it's, you know, out of desperation in a way. I think if anybody is growing desperate, it's them, not us. Because here we are, 63 years later, we are still speaking of Palestine and Palestinians and Nakba and all of this. I mean, why the sense of urgency? How did we manage to maintain the sense of urgency of an issue that Israel wished to be sorted out and finished and over with a long time ago, without the people in the way? You know, was it Moshe Dayan or Ben Gurion? I can't remember who's the one who assumed that the refugees will melt into the poor masses of the earth. Moshe Dayan. But they haven't. They're still there. We're still talking about them. So they build walls and add more and more checkpoints. They would attack Gaza and they would use this type of weapons. And then they think, well, maybe it wasn't effective enough. Let's try something even more lethal and more lethal and more lethal. Yeah. Yet nothing is happening. The Palestinians are still there. They're still holding on their rights and they are still fighting for the same demands that they've had many years ago. And now Israel is trying to find these creative ways to co-opt Palestinians. You have no right to remember the Nakba. How ridiculous is that? And it's even more ridiculous that if we forgot, and we would never do, now we would remember even more because of what they are expecting us to do.
So really it's a moment for us to change the discourse brought about by the boycott, divestment and sanctions to maybe restore Palestinian rights, and through that way maybe we can see a breakthrough, and that's perhaps where we should be focusing our attentions. And for full human rights for all Palestinians, for us to redefine the discussion, and for the Palestinians, as you said, people upwards, to take, not to wait for any government to take action, but to say, okay, negotiations haven't worked, politics hasn't worked, let's try a different tactic, go for boycott, divestment and sanctions, and take action ourselves, and with the call of the, you know, civil call from the Palestinians to use BDS as a way of reaching a new solution, and I think it's being felt by Israel. We know that in various publications recently that Israel is seen as one of the least popular countries. And I think I read in a holiday destination the Israelis around the world aren't making themselves
and
particularly...
Even more important than this, because sometimes they're not popular because of who they are. Because of the, you know, like, I was in this conference in Korea recently, and I found that we have all these friends in Central America. And some of them were friends of ours just because Israeli tourists behave really badly in their country. But I think there's a more important poll, actually, that was done by the Middle East Monitor, and the findings were published recently,
yeah.
that doesn't talk about how popular or not Israel is, but rather the people's relationship to this conflict, the people's relationship to this conflict. There is greater sympathy with Palestine than with Israel. And that is essential. It is essential because that is the time, this is the time where civil society becomes effective. We have the critical mass in European societies. The question is, how do we channel that support to achieve political ends? And I think not only do we need to redefine the Palestinian narrative within the discourse, I think we need to redefine our relationship to the discourse as a whole. What I mean by that is, you know, I don't think we should be consumed too much with one state, two states, violence, non-violence. That is an issue that Palestinians will sort out on their own, because they have their own dynamics. And these dynamics are happening independently from whatever the activists in Norway decide or don't. But what we really need to do, I was in South Africa recently, and I spoke to a group of lovely people in Johannesburg. And then I was told, but Ramzi, you're telling us all of this, and yet it's Palestinians are not united, and that makes it really difficult for us, which was really ironic, considering that we all know about the history of division of the anti-apartheid struggle. Who doesn't know that? We don't talk about it now because it's not very popular to address such, but in fact, there are divisions in any revolutions, in any time, in any place. So Palestinians are really not the exception. But then I discovered when I was there that there were still some military contracts that were signed between the apartheid government of South Africa and Israel that were never really canceled. And those military contracts included explosive bullets that are being shipped to Israel. And you know what explosive bullets do. And then I asked that gentleman, I said, did you know all of this? He said, no. So here I'm thinking, like, my gosh, here's this, you know, brother in Johannesburg, so worried about Hamas and Fatah reconciling or not. And he doesn't realize that he's actually funding, I mean, as a taxpayer, he's paying for all of this. So I'm thinking, we have got to reposition ourselves as well.
Exactly.
No, the battle for us is not Jerusalem. It's not Ramallah. It's not Gaza. These are important. It should inspire our battle. But our battle is London and Leeds and Toronto and Johannesburg. We need to ensure that we're not going to liberate Palestine. The Palestinians will. But we want to morally divest from Israel. And I think this is even more than important than the practical divestment, but the moral divestment. I want to have nothing to do with you. Whatever happens, happens in this conflict. But I'm not going to fund your war machinery. I am not going to contribute to your vile acts in Palestine. So I think this is where it really all starts.
I think, we hear about celebrations of the recognition of the State of Israel around the world. And the question that I ask myself is, what are they exactly recognizing? What are they recognizing? Are they recognizing Banistans? Are they recognizing ghettos? So I think that when you then begin to celebrate the recognition of the state of Palestine, you are accepting the status quo, and the status quo is the occupation. So I think we need to move our thinking forward and say, okay, well, no, we're not going to celebrate, because what are we celebrating? And we really do want to bring it back to, the youth demands and protests calling for unity. Maybe they have every right to do that, but to say to ourselves, we want more than simply recognizing of the state of Palestine. We want it to happen in reality. We want to try and answer the calls of the civil call for BDS by the Palestinians.
And I think the call for BDS by the Palestinians, and I think it was July 8th, 2005.
Yep.
I think it was really essential because again, the Palestinian civil society has been absent in all of this, and Palestine was viewed as factions and all of this. And it was a time where the Palestinian civil society stepped up to that challenge and presented a challenge to Western civil societies and civil societies everywhere that, this is what we need from you right now if you want to stand in solidarity with us. And I think this call is, I think what is fundamental at this point, that we build knowledge and awareness of what's going on in Palestine, if that call is to be effective. And I must say that I was in Olympia, Washington, 3 weeks ago. Then I went to Canada and I spoke there. We raised money for the Canadian boat to Gaza. Then in Scotland and back here in England. You see this happening everywhere. People are no longer talking about slogans. People are not talking about, these kind of endless debates and who started what, and they are talking about boycotting this, water cooler company or this, are talking about real things. We are getting involved. We are being part of this, and we are contributing. And I think it's essential that we continue the momentum of direct involvement.
Yeah, I mean, unity has to be a unified strategy and a set of outcomes, not just a sort of a sham marriage between, if you like, the Israelis and Fatah and Hamas, I think.
Right. So this is really bigger than Hamas and Fatah. I mean,
exactly.
If Hamas and Fatah decided to unify around the lines that are not accepted by the Palestinian people, is that okay? Of course not. So it's really not the unity per se. It's around what platform are they uniting, and is this platform consistent with the rights of the Palestinian people? I think that's even more important.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. Okay, well, I think I can feel that people are sort of itching to ask questions now, and I'd like to maybe open the floor and take a few questions, if I may, and
just
try and get Ramzi to answer some of those questions. So I'll take two or three at a time, and then we'll see how the time goes.
My name is Jafar. Jafar Ali, I'm a Palestinian. I'm 68 years old. I wrote you a couple of times. And what you said now is all commendable, warm and loving, towards your father. The Palestinian people never, ever come into play. They're ignored. Nobody has ever taken the trouble for a referendum to ask the Palestinians. Some of them are here, some of them in America, some of them in Australia. refugee camps, what is it you want? We have been ignored since the inception of Israel. We have been ignored by the Arabs. We have been ignored by the West. We have been ignored by the Fatah and the Hamas and the Jabhat al-Shaabi and all the political movements that have mushroomed over the last 63 years. I have never been asked, what do you want? And it's about time that somebody, maybe like you, and that's why I wrote you, because you are at the helm of the Palestine Chronicle, and I wrote to your counterpart, Mr. Ali Abu Nami, who has the WW and the father. And he kindly answered, and I saw him last night, what we want, the Palestinians, is to be asked. Our right, nobody can deny. Maybe they sweep it under the carpet, maybe they play politics with it. What I want as a Palestinian, and I have lived like your father, even more, and I was jailed by all the Arabs in Jordan, in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, and my wife was pregnant with our firstborn when I was invited officially by the government of Morocco and arrested at the airport because my sobriquet is Abu Nidal, the name of my son. It's about time, please, ask the Palestinians what they want.
I agree with you. But at the same time, nobody asked the Egyptians what they want either. They decided to answer that question on their own at Tahrir Square. I think it's only the Palestinians who are capable of pushing themselves into the heart of that equation. I don't think Mahmoud Abbas is going to really cares about what Palestinians want or not. What he really cares is to... What's that?
I don't care about him either.
Exactly. And most Palestinians don't. Most Palestinians don't care about him either.
None of these Abos represent me.
Exactly.
But
what are we going to do about it? That's what I'm saying.
That's what we've been saying.
Exactly.
That's exactly what we've been saying.
What I'd like you, as a journalist who has a platform to do, is ask the question, what do you want? Because by comparing...
No, we know what we want, Mr. Jaffer. We know exactly what we want.
My friend, it hasn't been canvassed. It hasn't been collected. We are part of a collective. We are looked upon by the entire universe, not as a nation. We are looked upon as part of two collectives. One, the Arab collective. Two, the Muslim Ummah. And I, for one, as a Palestinian Arab and as a Muslim, I resign from both. I am only a Palestinian. I want people to talk to me as a Palestinian, address me as a Palestinian, and listen to my grievances. I am not a victim. I refuse to be a victim. I am a landowner. I have a history twice the age of the West. And if I do not take the helm now, nobody will do it for me.
Exactly.
Well, thank you. I mean, you're very passionate about it, and I think that many of us Palestinians feel the same way. We do not want to be victims.
Right. We have to take charge.
We've got to take charge.
Nobody is going to ask you, Mr. Jaffer, what you want. If you don't answer that question on your own, nobody would do it. I think it's essential that we force ourselves into the heart of this equation. I think enough is enough. I think by saying that nobody cares about where we are and located in all of this, it's kind of in a way is perpetuating the same old question. But we are at a stage, we have this historical opportunity that we step forward and say that this is what we want, this is how we are situated in this narrative, and this is a Palestinian collective that is self-assured and capable of articulating these demands. And that's exactly what we've been talking about, and that's exactly what my book is about. So I think it's really important that we do so. I'm not saying that on a sentimental level. I think we do need a strategy and we need to discuss this. But I think mentally, we have to part with the past. We have to have new thinking and an entirely different take on how we've been conducting this.
Thank you. The gentleman at the back with the blue shirt wanted to ask a question, and then Fahim.
Can you just introduce yourself to us, please?
Yes, my name is Arif Lira. I'm Palestinian, of course. I agree with my brother, Najib here. Is that right? Yes,
Jafar.
Jafar, even better. I agree 100% with my brother Jafar. This is, you know, the problem with the Palestinians is that, I believe, in my humble opinion, is that we've been too nice and too polite and too, in our attitude towards people, that even when we see rubbish, we call it diamonds, you know? It is, we've got to get rid of. Who is Mahmoud Abbas and this is radical bullshit. This is, excuse my friend. They are the invention of, Kissinger and the rest of the, Zine al-Abidin Ben Ali and Mahmoud and Hosni Mubarak and the rest of the, how shall I say, rotten camp. So it's just, why do we accept? Why do you say president? President of what? You know, he's not even president of his own shoes.
Said that, rather than the people waiting for a man to, waiting for a man to emerge to lead them, that really the people should rise up and then, someone will emerge from amongst them. But don't you think it would be better if it was a woman rather than a man?
You have a man and a woman on stage,
and the reason I ask that is, something that's in my mind is, you had the whole Lula period in Brazil, this amazing, incredible change of the last 5 years of, Brazil coming from what was 5 or 10 years ago, this, huge country that people had virtually no respect for, that it was just a very poor place, and this is what it is. But within a short space of time, they've built something very powerful, and now Dilma Rousseff is the new president, and she's going to be leading that nation. I'm sure she's going to do a great job. And me personally, I'd like to see someone like maybe Leila Khaled, when she calms down a little bit from where she is and can get properly involved in politics. I don't think it would be better to have a woman than a man to lead.
There's no yes or no to this question. It's the Palestinian people who would have to determine, and I don't think they would be determining that based on gender or anything else. It would be based on the credibility of not even that person. Of the, one thing, I'm still living the euphoria of the Egyptian revolution, and one thing that I enjoyed about it is that days into the revolution, Al Jazeera reporters or news anchors are asking, those who are calling from the Tahrir Square, and they are saying, so who are your leaderships? Who are representing you? And then you would have a lady named Lubna saying, I think it's Muhammad al-Sayyid, one of them. Nobody, who's Muhammad al-Sayyid? Who's Lubna? And that was so beautiful about it, is that you had the collective uprising, and then the names were, followed. It wasn't the other way around. So I don't think we should concern ourselves at all. But as far as whether these people are available, and again, the question of where is your Palestinian Gandhi, I mean, every single day, we have so many Gandhis and Guevaras and people holding on the trees that are being uprooted in Kalkilia and Tulkarim and Jenin and in Gaza. I mean, these are the people, they are there. and they are more than capable of leading the new period in Palestine. But again, I think we need to move beyond complaining about the bad reality and just, you know, get moving. And I think we need to stop blaming others for our problems as well.
And we did celebrate women in the Intifada last week very well. And for the purposes of balance, I think I'd like to ask a woman the next question.
So, the lady in the orange top.
Yes, thank you. I'm Sandra Ramini. I'm a Palestinian by marriage. Ramzi, you said, which I think is very important, you said where we should be now fighting about is in London and Leeds and around Europe and America. And one of the huge forces for change that has been very, very recent, and nobody seems to have mentioned, and has brought in a great many people whom I know to suddenly understand the history of Palestine, was a series of television programs called The Promise, which was done by a most wonderful writer-director, I'm a journalist, writer-director called Peter Kosminski, who I believe is Jewish, and who made a very excellent remark in a discussion about the making of these programs, which he didn't make because he said, I had a message. I just wanted to tell the true story. And he used 11 years it took to get the research together, and every single scene, every word, every nuance in that series can be backed by sources. It's a very, very exciting thing. Now, the greatest propaganda machine is, of course, Hollywood, which is, of course, run by the Jews. But, obviously, I haven't read your book. We've had little bits of it. It seems to have a lovely narrative in it. Surely, there is now a time that Channel 4 put this series of programs on. It's 8 hours of television. All of it seemed to be by the Israelis as totally anti-Israel and totally anti-Jewish, which, in fact, it isn't. It's simply accurate. But it got on. It got on peak time television in this country. It's sold in Australia. They're now selling it all over the place. And this is where, you know, there are other areas, not just politics, not just talking, not just writing important editorial,
thank you.
But in the popular media.
Can I just say, in support of that, I've worked in television for a long time, Palestinian, born and bred outside Palestine, unfortunately. I worked a lot in television, had many successful programs on some major Arabic language networks, and I'm still waiting to see some Palestinian money go into a proper network where the talent and the writers and the presenters and the reporters and the creators can come together and create something. Let's not forget how valuable Al Jazeera was to the revolutions that did take place. This is very important, and it's really very late. And I see a lot of Palestinian money put into all sorts of projects, but the media is always the last thing to think about. I remember that I got a scholarship to go and study media, which I did in the States. And when I came back to the Arab world, and people said to me, well done, what have you done? And I said, I did media, of course, because it's very important. They laughed at me. They thought, what a waste of time. I'm still waiting.
It's really hard to answer this question. I think part of it is that we kind of reached the point where we felt, you know, like the whole idea that Hollywood is controlled by the Jews. I mean, we kind of reached this kind of, we have been polarized as far as our relationship to the media. Someone else controls it, don't even try, don't even bother. And that's why I think, again, I need to bring the ball back into our court. I think we need, you know, I'm not going to tell you about the Palestine Chronicle and our tiny, tiny, tiny little budget, but the fact that we reach about 25,000 visitors every single day. If I worried too much about how much money I need to get this started, I would have never got started. And I think some of the most effective work that has been done by media people, by journalists, by activists, by movie makers who had nothing by way of budget. So I really don't think that money is in itself. I think the will. I mean, there has got to be the will and the willingness to get started on this. And you know, I've heard this argument over the money, and where, well, of course, I mean, if I have $1 million, I'm a millionaire, and if I'm a millionaire, I'm self-seeking, and I have my own interest, and it's essential that we kind of escape that argument and think of ways to communicate the message in as effective of a way as possible, considering the resources we have. Of course, I would like to see more and more money invested in this, but I'm not going to wait until someone comes with the millions and invest them. I'm going to do things on my own, and I know that you are already doing things on your own, and so many people over here are doing the same and getting the message across. And I think that's what we should be focusing on.
Thank you. I'm going to take 3 more questions. Please introduce yourself and keep your questions brief. So Dima, Yusuf, and 4 more questions. Harry and the young lady by the speakers at the back. Okay.
I'm Dima Hamdan, and as you know, probably my film Gaza London was inspired by your book. My name is Dima Hamdan. My question is regarding, you've been talking about the revolutions that we've seen in the Arab world recently. It's the normal people, the Muhammads and the Zarifas, who have started these things, and it's not the leaderships. Rather than talking about what ought to happen, in the short term, what do you think the scenario would be in Palestine? Because we've seen people coming out and demonstrating, asking for an end to division, but the Palestinians are fighting against a divided Palestinian leadership, they're fighting against the occupation, and in fact they're fighting against the Israeli people in a way, because it is the people in Israel, you know, unless they move and they decide that it's time to make peace, they're also the third barrier in the Palestinian struggle. So if we are to witness a kind of popular uprising, what do you think the outcome in the short term would be?
Okay. 2 things. First, thank you, Dima, and thank you for that beautiful film you did. I really appreciate it. 2 things. First, I think, I think we have to be aware of the fact that, yes, people went to the streets and made broad change in Egypt and Tunisia, but they are being watched, and there are every attempt at quashing the revolutions. And I think the U.S. involvement in Libya was very much that. I really don't think it was about the oil. They were getting the oil anyway. It was about taking the initiative from the Arab people and turning what is purely a people's rebellion into something entirely different. So there is a level of demoralization going on. And I hope it doesn't continue forever. However, that said, in 1982, the Palestinian leadership, the Lebanon War happened, and the Palestinian, and Sabra and Shatila, and the Palestinian leadership was sent to Tunisia, and Palestinian fighters in Lebanon were everywhere, from Yemen to Somalia to Sudan. And we passed through a period of several years in which the leadership wasn't just divided politically, was divided physically as well. That division then was even worse than the division that we are experiencing right now in Palestine. But worse, when Arabs began meeting and holding their Arab League summits, they were saying very little about Palestine. Even the lip service they used to pay to Palestine, they were not paying it anymore. And then the Israeli occupation became even more wicked and more violent, more violent. And then 4 men from my village, from Beit Daras, were ran over by an Israeli truck driver in Gaza, and they were killed. And then I remember that day, because I was a student at Khalid Ibn Walid High School, and our high school is right on the highway, and that's where the settlers would pass and the Israeli soldiers, and we just didn't know what to do. So we basically went down to the highway and we just blocked it. And the Israeli soldiers came and the settlers, and they began shooting. And then the opposite refugee camp, Barrage, took to the streets too when a couple of our students were killed. And then Maghazi, and then Khan Yunis, and then Gaza, and then Rafah, and then Nablus and Ramallah. And then Palestinians within Palestine 48. And then suddenly there was a revolution. And that revolution, even though it was presented as kids with stones, the underpinnings of that revolution, it was a stance against division, it was bringing back the Palestinian factor into the equation. It actually revived the Palestinian leadership in Tunisia that was long neglected. It restated the importance of Palestine as within the Arab conscience. It once more revived the struggle. And it took few students from Khalid ibn Walid High School in Nusayrat to achieve all of this. And I really think, I mean, you cannot urge a revolution. You cannot call on people. I mean, if you know, those who understand how Palestinian uprisings happen, and I've heard Palestinian leaders in Damascus and elsewhere calling on the Palestinian people to carry out a third uprising. I'm sorry, it doesn't happen that way. It never happened that way. And it didn't happen that way in Egypt either. But I think it's the Palestinian people in Palestine who will eventually restate their importance to the struggle. And believe me, once that happens, all these old illusions and Oslos and this ugly hierarchy that was created, the corruptions within our societies that was espoused by the PA, the Israeli occupation, the settlements project, all of this within days would change. And we have seen that change happening in 18 days in Egypt. Now we are talking about a brand new reality. And it's America that's repositioning itself from that reality. For the first time in many years, America has been leading change, playing around with people's lives and geography and politics. And suddenly, it's not that way anymore. We have done this before. In 36, we've done it. In 87, we've done it. In 2000, we've done it. And we will do it again. I'm sure of it.
Thank you. Okay.
Yusuf Akhalo, a freelance journalist, came from Gaza 2 weeks ago and visiting here. Thank you very much, Ramzi. It's an honor meeting you today here. I think we as Palestinians, you know, we should be proud of being Palestinians. We should educate ourselves before, you know, and we should actually make our voices heard. We shouldn't expect people to ask us what we need. We should tell the people who we are, what we need, what is the problem, how they can help. My question is that, of course, there's 6 million Palestinian refugees, you know, scattered all over the world. And, of course, in the light of the failure of the so-called peace talks, how can we still, after like 6 decades, we still did not see any leadership like emerging, any somebody emerging from the outside of Palestine? I mean, why the Palestinians outside the Palestinian territories do not exert enough effort? I mean, are they like lacking the measures or the means or the money? And also, don't you think that we should seize or, you know, make use of the power of the people outside Palestine, you know, to do something?
Absolutely. That's very essential, Yusuf. I mean, I think it's a bit overdue for self-criticism here. I mean, we've got to recognize our failures. And I haven't brought this up because I was, you know, kind of pushing for an entirely different subject, the discussion, which is the importance of repositioning the Palestinian narrative because of what it actually means, you know, to take Palestine out of this, you know, victimization complex. Yes, we have been victimized, but we are not victims. We refuse to be victims. And that's exactly what Israel wants us to do. But what you said, it's very important. And I think the ills and ailments that afflicted our society in Palestine also afflicted it in diaspora. And I really wanted to keep this upbeat and optimistic. But I can tell you many examples of that division that I saw wherever I go. I mean, Mr. Jaffer here spoke about how Palestine is hijacked into, you know, this collective and that collective, and in the midst of it, Palestine itself is being lost. And I found myself in these, you know, in these overlapping collectives, and as a speaker, you kind of find yourself trying to renegotiate your relationship to these collectives, as opposed to them finding their way to where you stand. So it's really been really hard. I mean, one day you are speaking at Ahmed Didat's mosque in Durban, and you have to use certain language and certain, and the other time you are, you know, you are speaking at a communist conference in Detroit. And you find yourself, and again, it's essential to create associations. It's a successful strategy, but you can't fall entirely into that sets of associations. You kind of lose the plot altogether. And I think Palestinians in diaspora are a reflection, really, of Palestinians at home. I mean, we have our Hamas and Fatahs and Jabhat Sha'biyas, and many of the conferences and many of the events are divided based on that as well. And that's unfortunate. And I think we can, as you know, civil society, interfere in this and try, you know, kind of take that narrative back and say we are not going to fall into that factionalism that has deprived Palestine from its Palestinian identity and has been hijacked into religious, ideological, or any other rational. It's important that we do so. But the good news is that it is indeed happening. It really is happening. And those of you who saw Ali Abu Na'mi yesterday, he was pushing for a similar agenda as well. And I see this happening everywhere. And I think we are encouraged. Like, you know, when you do something, you are a brilliant reporter, and I've seen you on Press TV many times, and you've done... you guys, Yusuf Al-Hilu has done such a wonderful job communicating a message, beautiful message coming out of Gaza. So thank you for that, Yusuf. But you know what? You will find lots of young Palestinians who look at Yusuf Al-Hilu and say, I would like to be like this. And if he has a platform...
It's our duty.
Exactly. But when I write a book, you know, I am looking at Ghada Karmi's book, and she looked at someone else's book, and suddenly... We have a new narratives, and eventually we will have the discourse. We just cannot despair. We have got to keep on pushing, and we have to be clear about our demands and objectives. And really, I don't like complaining. I really complain very little. And I expect myself to do things, because honestly, complaining is kind of deprives you from the ability. It's disempowering. In fact, you know one term I don't use, Yusuf? In America, the powerful Zionist lobby. I don't use the powerful. I mean, we've kind of alienated this discourse in a way that we kind of stand there and we say, we just need cement to build our houses in Gaza. I mean, that's all that we expect that we can say. We are victims and they are all powerful. We need to challenge that. We need to challenge their narratives and claim our own.
Yep, absolutely. We have run out of time, but if the questions are very quick, then I'll let them through. So, Harry.
I think there's a lady over there.
There's just two more.
Okay. Hey, Harry.
Hi, I'm Harry. I'm a documentary filmmaker and activist, and my question's quick. You're talking about sort of the info war, basically, the Palestinian narrative and pushing it. In the West, London, as you mentioned. And you talk about some of the media and this sort of thing. In short, what is the sort of campaign that we should be pushing? Is it one central on international justice, or what?
I think there are two narratives. One is, how does this conflict relate to you as someone who is living in London, and then someone who is living in the UK, and then as someone who is living in Europe? So you need to localize. We, as Palestinians, we need to internationalize our narrative, and we want to reach a point where I don't have to borrow from anybody's history. And I would say Nakba, and you understand exactly what that's all about. I say Naksa, and you would immediately understand what... So we need to internationalize a conflict that has been localized by Oslo and the Palestinian Authority and divided us politically and socially and then territorially into areas A's and B's and C's. And with all these divisions, we also became divided from within psychologically. We became divided. We need to change that. But then you cannot international. You have to localize it. Because it matters to you, because that grocery store across the street is selling Israeli products. And you see what I mean? So you kind of need to reach it from the other way around. So I hope that this addressed part of your question.
Thank you. Okay, last question.
Hi, just very quick, but first, I really like Frank Gramsci, and I have to say that it was through Gramsci that I first went to Palestine a few years ago. I had the pleasure of meeting him in New York. I think you haven't seen him in 17 years now. And only after reading your book, after meeting both of you, I could really see that, how it was inevitable that your parents were going to bring up two incredibly kind, eloquent, and indefatigable children.
Thank you.
The question is mainly about to do with Gaza, about how I think over the years we've always seen how whatever happens, or over several occasions when something happens, the West Bank, it's always Gaza that pays the price, whether it was the lynching of two soldiers, let's say October 2000, during the Intifada, Gaza would get bombarded afterwards. And now, with the Egyptian revolution, and Egypt still having the same army that's been paid for by America, and we see that there hasn't really been any change with the border so much, do you think that it's going to be a good thing for the people of Gaza, what's happening now? Or do you think that the Egyptians will be so preoccupied with their problems and the same army that has always done this, the people of Gaza will continue doing so?
Yes, it will bring good things to Gaza. And again, simply because it's the ordinary people of Egypt who led that revolution. If this was a classical revolution in the old sense of, you know, a couple of guys with rifles overthrowing some other guys with rifles and taking their place, I would have said, well, you know, it depends on the guy, the new guys with the rifles. Maybe they are better guys with rifles. But in the case of Egypt, it's different. Because you and I know very well what the Egyptian people stand for. You and I know very well what the Iraqi people stand for. When I go to Egypt, when I go to Iraq, and they know you are a Palestinian, it's like, you descended from heaven. I mean, there's this thing that, to the point that I also feel like there's a level of, you know, objectifying Palestinians in a way, but in a positive way. So we know what Egyptians feel about Gaza and about the Palestinian people. If this remains, if this revolution remains true to the demands and to the wishes and to the spirit of the Egyptian people, and it will, eventually a difference is going to be made. But I have to also warn you that the hyenas are also circulating this revolution, and they are trying to, you know, the counter-revolution is happening. And the counter-revolution is not just happening by, you know, the old followers of the regime. It's also happening by the outside. I mean, David Cameron, for example, was the first foreign leader to visit Cairo, and he was so shameless that he takes 6 bosses of the biggest armed, I mean, and you know how he describes that. He says, now it totally escaped me. He describes this as instilling the demands of democracy in Egypt. The armed dealers are there to ensure that the basis of democracy are actually solid. How ridiculous. I mean, the fact that they supply Libya with weapons, then their weapons bomb the other weapons that they supplied Libya with. And so they are at work as well. Egypt in particular is extremely important to them. The IMF immediately offered Egypt this huge package of billions of dollars. You know, just take, how much money do you want? They are trying to entangle Egypt. Because they know that there's a moment of truth that is coming. And that is, whether the government likes it or not, whether the army likes it or not, when the Egyptian people are going to come and exact another price, and they say, listen, this in Gaza is not going to continue. So this is what's happening right now. The Egyptian people are solidifying, and they are articulating their own relevance to this political discourse, and on the other hand, there are many others who are trying their best to weaken the Egyptian position. But I have every hope to believe. I mean, at this point today, for example, there was the mass protest for journalists demanding names and faces to be fired. I mean, they are going that specifics in their demands. They are aware. They have unearthed their inner power as a people. And if that continues, I don't see a reason of why the siege would continue.